Survivors of Butte County's campfire are burdened by more than just the painful memories of their escape. Many are navigating the stress of displacement and the confusing bureaucracies of filing insurance claims or for federal aid. Reporter Pauline Bartoloni will join us with stories from the evacuees. UC Berkeley forestry specialist William Stewart explains what geologists are concerned about as winter storms move through the devastated campfire area in Butte County. The Christmas play, Miracle on 34th Street, begins this weekend at Sacramento City College. We'll get into the spirit with the director and two actors from the show. And the Philharmonic will perform at a benefit show for campfire evacuees this weekend. We'll revisit his full-length album released earlier this year. I'm Beth Duncan in for Beth Ruyak. That's today on Insight. First, the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Duncan in for Beth Ruyak. Geologists spend a lot of time creating landslide risk maps after a major wildfire happens. The slope of the landscape, the amount of rainfall, and underlying geology of an area all play a role in how likely an area might be affected. Forestry specialist William Stewart from UC Berkeley joins us to explain what geologists are concerned about as winter storms move through the fire-devastated areas. Bill, welcome to Insight.
Well, good morning. Thank you.
So why do we worry about landslides following wildfires? How often do they actually happen?
Well, after a wildfire, you know, what had been on the ground, all the litter's been burned off, a lot of the plants are dead, some of the soil becomes basically water repellent from basically baking the clays and some of the other oils in there. So water, the rain that's going to come down normally that used to basically go into the soil will often run off a lot faster and can, you know, build up from small landslides, can kind of, a few of them can come together into what are called debris flows, where you have both rocks and soil and water all coming down at once, like we saw in Montecito last year. So that is, this is a big concern after every wildfire. We send a lot of professionals out there trying to map areas of the highest risk and make sure that the people or homes or infrastructure below them are, that we know where those risks are to try to take some of the preventative measures.
So let's talk about debris. Can you define what we're dealing with when you talk about debris? Is it the burned out houses? Is it ashes? Explain that, please.
No, basically after the wildfire, there is a lot of burnt logs and other things there. But what happens when it starts raining, that it'll saturate the soil and you'll start to get just the soil movement. But once you get a fair bit of it moving down, it can basically pick up the boulders and other things in the soil and pull down whole trees. So a debris flow has just both mud and water and big chunks of rocks and logs in there. And that's what actually can, if it hits a bridge or a home or a commercial center, can just wipe it out. It's just a huge amount of force that just levels everything in its path.
So what about debris from the insides of homes that have been destroyed? A lot of technology in homes and different things that we use every day. Is that a toxic problem?
Yeah, they found this in the Tubbs Fire in Santa Rosa when they realized, because there's so many homes were burned, not as many as Paradise, but were burned in just, you know, we have a lot of electronics in everybody's home. People have hobbies, they have things in their garage, and all that stuff is now burned, and it's going to wash down into the creeks and streams. So this is a big, kind of a newer concern, I'd say, that we didn't really think about as much 30 years ago, that these big wildfires burning through residential areas also create all this basically heavy metal and other toxic debris in the outflow that's going to wash down towards basically the Sacramento Valley.
And how does that affect the waterways?
I think main way, it just looks like dirt to you and me, but for small fish and animals that live in there, a lot of that stuff is toxic to them. So there probably will be basically, it's a new source of essentially industrial pollutants are being put into a lot of our waterways. How much, I'm not really sure about, but there was quite a bit of electronics that were incinerated in the fire there.
Would you swim in that water next summer?
No.
How long do you think it would take until the water cleans itself out, so to speak?
You know, I think most of it's going to be washed out probably this, if this is a average rain season, it'll probably wash most of it out, but there'll be some in the smaller creeks and small tributaries. There might be some in the soil. I wouldn't be digging up. I wouldn't have my kids go out there and play in the mud for a while.
And what kind of area are we talking about?
You know, I think for these fires, all the tributaries that drain, the big fires we've had, the Camp Fire, the whole Mendocino Complex, the Carr Fire, the Delta Fire, all those areas where you're going to have the drainage coming out, waiting basically for the system to flush itself out.
So if you're a hiker, for instance, could you purify that water and drink it?
Well, most people don't hike. I think in the for daytime, people probably don't want to take their own water if they're hiking in the foothills. In some of those areas, as burnover, there's going to be some pretty nice wildfires probably next year, but I would basically take my own water if I was hiking in the foothills below any of these fires.
So as we head into our rainy season in winter and into spring, how long is it a problem with potential slides and debris, mudslides, et cetera? Are we looking at an issue like all the way through this season?
Yeah, I think what we see is pretty much over the next 4 years, the risk of increased level of landslides are going to be high. It's going to be highest this year, and then next year might be only half of what it was, and then half again. So then 3 or 4 years, most of the additional risk from the wildfires is gone. But for these next 3 or 4 years, the risks of increasing landslides, especially if we have a really big winter and later in the winter when the soil is just full of water, it just has a lot less strength to stay on the hillside compared to when before it was burned. Now it's just a lot weaker, and it's a lot easier to break off and create a new landslide.
I'm talking with UC Berkeley forestry specialist William Stewart about the concerns of geologists as these winter storms move through many areas devastated by wildfires. How long that we will be concerned in terms of the safety of people and even trying to go in there and rebuild?
From the landslide risk?
Landslide risk and the toxicity?
Yeah, I think what's unique about the area of where the campfire paradise is pretty much on a relatively flat plateau there. So they're very, very different than Southern California, where people are, you know, most of the residential areas are beneath where the landslides would run out on them. Rebuilding in paradise, the landslide risk is actually, that's one of the few things that is a low risk there. And the runoff is going to go down into the Butte Creek and into the Feather River Canyon, where, you know, not many people live down in the canyons. So the risk to human life from these landslides after these fires is much more severe in Southern California, just because they live beneath where the landslides are, rather than we do more than Northern California, live kind of in meadows or plateaus, a little bit out, not in the canyons, and not at the runout.
So, and speaking of Southern California, should we build differently in areas like that where they're below this kind of situation?
Well, this has gone on for a long time, unfortunately, in Southern California. In 1934, 80 people died in a single debris flow down there right outside of Los Angeles. So they've, over time, have built very large, what they call debris basins, and don't let people build in areas where they've mapped out where the big runout zones are. Sometimes those debris basins aren't big enough, which was kind of the case in Montecito, but they've actually, because this has gone on for nearly 100 years, they've tried to keep as many people historically out of harm's way. But I think what we're seeing with more wildfires, we probably have underzoned there in terms of where the risk areas are. So I think people and planners in Los Angeles County, Ventura County, Santa Barbara County are going to be looking a little bit harder about how they would actually build and protect people and infrastructure beneath these areas that are going to be probably burning at an increased frequency over the next few decades.
And back to Northern California, we have been so focused on the horrific fire in Paradise. There were other fires, though. And I noticed in some of my notes that you might be concerned about I-5 and bridges in different areas that we're really not thinking about since we're focused on Paradise. Can you address that a little bit in terms of issues that might be a problem?
Yeah, I think the campfire, I think that's going to put the Feather River Canyon and Highway 70 at risk for landslides and being cut off there. But that's the same issue happens up in the Sacramento River Canyon north of Redding, where the Delta fire burned through there. That's a major corridor of I-5 coming down from the northwest. And that has the same problem, large areas of burned hillsides with drainages basically dumping right onto I-5. So I could see those areas, those steep areas, if they have some high rainfall or some big thunderstorms over them, that we could have some fairly large debris slides and landslides coming up onto that major corridor, which has a much more traffic than Highway 70 or Highway 36.
So does this present a future research project for you or your colleagues?
This has been an area of, I used to work on this when I worked at the U.S. Geological Survey. This has been an area that researchers have worked a long time on trying to actually map this, and improve kind of our understanding of this now that we have better information on the topography and the rainfall and the understanding of how strong soils are after the wildfire. But this is clearly going to be an area that more work needs to be done to protect human health and safety, as well as infrastructure that we have may cross rivers or creeks at kind of low areas that they could be washed out in the next 20 years. So I think fortifying a lot of these pieces is going to be an area we're going to have to invest more research and more basically better infrastructure and better zoning in the next 20, 30 years.
Tell me about the NASA landslide viewer. What is that?
So this is an example that trying to understand where landslides are the probability of them. NASA has been put together, take a lot of data they collect from satellites for the topography, the types of soil, the precipitation, and basically created a landslide prediction map for the whole globe. And you can zoom in there just right into any place as small as neighborhoods around Paradise to looking at landslides in some other country. But that's an example of taking all this digital information we have now and pulling it together to bring better information to decision makers so they can think about where are higher risks, where have landslides occurred historically, to do better planning as we move forward.
As a geologist, what's your biggest worry about our area now following these devastating fires?
I think that for Northern California, I think we're going to have a lot of our road and bridge infrastructure is probably going to be, there could be some unexpected failures we have there that's going to throw things off. I think luckily we don't have that many people living in areas where debris flows put them at risk. I think looking at mapping, given how many acres burned in this last season, in the last two seasons, there's tens of thousands of acres of where people have residential areas where they're underneath hillsides that have been burned off. So I think it's up to kind of county, state, and federal governments to start coordinating to better map this and communicate where these areas of high risk are and what should be done about them.
That is forestry specialist William Stewart talking about what geologists are concerned about as winter storms move through areas devastated by fire. Bill, thank you for being on Insight.
Thank you very much. Bye.
We have more on our website at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Duncan in for Beth Ruyak. Survivors of the Butte County's campfire are facing new burdens as they navigate the stress of being homeless, along with bureaucracies of filing insurance claims or trying to get federal aid. Joining us today is reporter Pauline Bartoloni. Pauline is a reporter. She lives in Sacramento. Her work has been featured in the Los Angeles Times, Washington Post, on CNN and National Public Radio, as well as right here on Capital Public Radio. She's been talking with evacuees and hearing their stories. Pauline, welcome to Insight.
Thanks, Beth. Good to be here.
So you've been talking to a lot of folks over the last week and a half, actually, and it's really intense, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. There's so much to talk about. You could do three stories a day, I'm sure, if you just did scoped in on specific people and their experience. What's the experience for you been like hearing about all this tragedy?
Oh, well, for me, nothing, you know, compares to what the actual survivors are experiencing. But, you know, all I have to do is walk up to somebody, a survivor at one of the recovery centers and say, I'm a reporter. And they just burst open at the seams, ready to tell their story and have so much emotions.
So they want to talk to you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Over the phone, you know, in person, when I ask them about the day of their escape, you get, you know, a 30-minute story, just a very detailed, vivid account. Clearly, people are traumatized by narrowly escaping death and then the stress afterwards, trying to figure out how to navigate the chaos of their lives.
Do you get the sense that people are telling these stories over and over and over again, and perhaps that's some kind of therapy for them?
Yeah. I visited some of the shelters, and they had Red Cross was actually giving people some mental health care. And they said every time somebody tells their stories, they heal a little more. And that's actually a little debatable among psychologists, because some people say, well, you don't want people to keep telling stories of their trauma because then they can get re-traumatized. Mm-hmm. They say it depends on the person. Some people find it very cathartic to share their stories, and some people would prefer to focus on the practicalities of moving on.
And that can be really a personality type, right? Because there are those of us who talk about things that are going on in our lives, and some of us keep it in our head. So it could be actually what kind of person they are and how they express themselves too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the psychologists I talked to, they said that, you know, whatever kind of mental health care you get, the important part is getting it early intervention. So there's different ways of getting therapy, but important part is getting it as soon as possible.
And so what are the mental health challenges right now in the midst of all this?
Yeah, well, I talked to this one guy, Joe Pickett. He was living in his car for 11 days after he escaped from the fire. And, you know, he ran past people burning up in their cars, neighbors burning up outside their houses. He says he's, you know, been crying. He has a lot of grief, sadness, but he also, the days after, have just been a blur. So he's just trying to focus on where to get a good sleep every night. He went back to his brothers and is sleeping in a house in Megalia, which is the next town over from Paradise. But people can't necessarily spend a lot of time focusing on that harrowing event. They just have to focus on what's next. I talked to another person in a shelter. He has survivor's guilt.
Yes.
He's a recent resident of Megalia. And he says, he's a young guy. He said, you know, I didn't really value my life that much before this fire. And now after the fire and realizing so many of my neighbors lost their lives, that I value my life that much more for those people who lost their lives. And he's taking to art. He's drawing pictures for other evacuees in the shelters using blue and green colors because he says he doesn't want to use red and yellow and orange in his drawings that will remind people of the fire.
Have you talked to people who feel like they wish or they feel they could have helped somebody? So they're really feeling running past somebody that's literally on fire. That's a horrific vision.
Yeah. I think people just were running to survive, save their own lives, and they couldn't if they wanted to live.
They couldn't. What are people saying about returning to the scene of the fire?
A lot of people want to go back just to see their homes, see what's left. I've talked to a bunch of evacuees who have managed to go back just for a visit to see if anything was salvageable,
right,
especially before the rains we got last week, because they wanted to see before everything washed away if there were anything metal or precious that they could find. The evacuation orders are still in place for most of Paradise and a lot of other areas. So people are just waiting for word about when the roads will open, when the schools will be viable, when their kids can go back to school. There's just a lot of uncertainty right now.
So are people being taken in small groups or not at all yet in the Paradise area?
For the Paradise area, I think it's pretty much the evacuation orders are still in place.
Okay.
I have heard of people going back, and Megalia, which is northern, it's kind of the next town over northeast, I guess you could say, one person has gone back that I've heard of.
And did you talk to that person?
Yeah, he's just sleeping in his brother's house. And, you know, there are other people who still have their homes, but say without the roads being open and without the schools being open, they don't know how they can live there. There's no businesses. Their grocery stores may be an hour drive away.
No electricity.
No electricity, running water, right? So that's the big question right now. This one business owner I talked to who owned a restaurant called The Depot in Megalia, his home is still standing, but his restaurant burned down. And he said, you know, even if I wanted to move back there, could I find the employees or even the customers to go to the restaurant? You know, his restaurant actually had a fire a year and a half ago, and he had to rebuild the kitchen. And he said the permitting process took months, and it was hard to find the labor. So now with everybody needing, you know, permits and labor to rebuild, it's going to, you know, may take years and may not be viable for some people.
When you talk to people, you probably get both attitudes, but are you seeing some that say, I'm here, I'm rebuilding no matter what, this is my home?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I talked to a few people over the past week that said, no matter what, I'm going there. It's the only thing I know. These hills around Paradise are the only thing I know. They don't have family elsewhere. They don't have connections, resources. And they say, I'm absolutely going back no matter what.
So you've been able to kind of talk to people and look at the situation. How is the help going in terms of access to, for instance, mental health recovery or just access to food or survival right now?
Yeah. Well, Butte County Behavioral Health Department has been in contact with some of the folks who were already in the mental health care system before the fire. So they're visiting shelters and checking in on people. There are also counseling services available if folks drop into the disaster recovery centers in Chico and Oroville. And actually, Anthem Blue Cross, a health insurer, offered free telehealth video sessions with folks who need counseling services. So you could use your phone or your laptop to get counseling services that way.
Do you get a sense of frustration about being able to find the things that they need, the people, stories of I can't get whatever it is?
Yeah, definitely at the shelters, people are saying, where's the housing? I'm tired of sleeping in a tent or, you know, the folks who are at the Walmart parking lot or elsewhere. But people are getting fatigued. You know, it's coming on 3 weeks already. They want to know what FEMA is going to provide them.
I'm talking with reporter Pauline Bartoloni. She's been interviewing evacuees, hearing their stories, and sharing the challenges they face after the Camp Fire disaster. So what are the kids doing? I think any parent knows if your kid's home from school, you wish the school would open very quickly.
Yeah.
And to have all these young kids that are just now, they're not in school. Who's entertaining them? What are they doing? They must be going crazy.
Mm-hmm. I did visit with a couple of families who have kids who are out of school right now. I should say that the school district is talking about reopening at least one school December 3rd, I think the date was. So that's next week.
Coming up next week, yes.
But some of the families are saying, you know, they have doubts about that, or are the teachers going to be back in time to staff the schools? But the kids I saw, you know, they're in hotel rooms or staying with family, staying with their cousins. The one family, the restaurant owner, he told me that they're thinking of starting homeschooling their kids.
So you haven't seen any kind of organized activity for the kids? In other words, there's not a makeshift school going on in a gymnasium right now or anything. It's kind of everybody on their own still?
That's what it sounds like to me. I have heard whispers of, you know, families who've already decided not to go back, that their kids may integrate into other school districts.
So talk to me a little bit about some story or something that maybe affected you the most, or a family or some situation that when you got in the car to come home that evening from your work as a reporter, you couldn't let go of.
I think it was visiting with Joe Pickett, who was living in his car with his two dogs and his bird for 11 days, who by himself was dealing with these memories of escaping the fire and seeing people literally in flames. And, you know, there are a lot of people who are in shelters. They have resources, or even the people in the Walmart parking lot. A lot of other folks are staying with family, but he was alone. So that was heavy to see that.
How about the animals? People love their animals, and there's such a comfort to people, especially in times that are so devastating like this. So are you seeing them hanging out with their dogs and what else? Cats and birds and who knows what?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the way people have described it to me is that these animals are their family members, too. And some of them are a means of protection, you know? they're little furry bodyguards for them. But I have noticed how meaningful these animals are to them for comfort and, you know, and love. But also, I think because of the rural lifestyle that is commonplace in the Paradise area, people had a lot of space for animals. So that was often the first thing they did when they decided to evacuate. They got their animals, put them in the car, or ran with them.
Are there stories about people who've lost their animals that they express to you?
I'm following one family that can't find their cat, but do have a dog. I'm sure there are countless other stories, but actually most of the families that I've talked to, they still have their animals.
Are you going back on a daily basis? What is your plan to continue covering this?
I've been going to the evacuation centers and just talking to people outside. I'm planning on covering the recovery effort, the rebuilding process for the next year, because this is, you know, a marathon, not a sprint. You know, it's not just how do we clean up the debris and how do we find the dead. It's following how a community rebuilds itself, and there are a lot of challenges to that.
Any word from FEMA regarding any temporary shelter that's on its way?
You know, I heard on NPR this morning that there are 80 FEMA trailers, but I actually checked with FEMA, and they said that there are trailers at McClellan Air Force Base, but they're not related to the wildfires and they're not on their way. What FEMA is providing right now is hotel assistance, like vouchers for displaced families, and rental assistance for people wanting to rent an apartment. They're giving cash aid to people who need to buy things like fuel, food, water, and they also have unemployment assistance for folks who lost their jobs because of the fire.
And still there's a list of the missing.
Yep, and it changes every day. It's down to a few hundred now, down from over 1,000, I believe.
That is reporter Pauline Bartolone. Pauline, thank you for coming in and being on Insight.
Thanks, Beth, for having me.
We have more on our website at capradio.org/insight. You are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Duncan in for Beth Ruyak. Miracle on 34th Street returns to Sacramento this holiday season. City Theater at Sacramento City College presents the classic Christmas play beginning this weekend and running through December 16th. Luther Hansen is directing the production, and he joins actor Josh Caldwell and actress Anna Montine in studio to talk about the play. And we'll also hear a scene. But starting off, we've got a lot of people that don't know this play. Can you give me a little synopsis, Luther?
Sure. The play, the script, was written by Mountain Community Theater in, I believe, the 1984, and it's based on the film and on the original novel by Valentine Davies. And it's really fun. It's about a man who is named Kris Kringle, and he believes that he's Santa Claus, and he becomes very valuable to Macy's department store. And he is put on trial to find out whether he's Santa Claus. And Josh plays Fred Gailey, who is the lawyer who is trying to help prove that he's Santa Claus.
Sounds like a great family.
It's really, really fun.
Great family play. Luther, welcome to Insight. Luther's here. That's who you just spoke, just heard from. But joining us also is Josh Caldwell. He plays Fred Gailey in Miracle on 34th Street. Josh, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
How's your character? How do you like doing what you're doing?
Oh, I love Fred.
Yeah?
Yeah. I've always wanted to play a lawyer. Always. I'm one of those people who believes in, even if you don't believe something, it's worth fighting for. If I necessarily don't believe he's Santa Claus, he believes that he's Santa Claus. It's not going to hurt anybody. So why not?
Yeah. Ho, ho, ho. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
So you heard from the director, Luther Hansen, and we also have Josh Caldwell, who plays Fred. And now joining us as well is Anna. And pronounce your last name.
It's Muntian.
Muntian?
Muntian.
Muntian. Oh, that's lovely. Anna Muntian is here with us as well. She plays Doris Walker in the production. Anna, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
And tell me about your character and your role.
So I play the part of Doris, and she is a manager at Macy's, and she's actually the one who hires Kris Kringle to be the Santa Claus at the parade and kind of at the Macy's. I kind of have a love interest going on with Fred or Josh. And it's just throughout the whole play, it's kind of discovering for herself what she believes in and having this change of heart and believing in something that might be kind of out there. So it's been really fun getting to play, you know, a character who's at first very cold and very like withdrawn, and then having her at the end of the play actually care about all this stuff that's going on.
So I think we should hear this scene.
Okay.
All right.
Are you guys ready?
Certainly.
Sure. Do you need to set it up for us?
No.
I think the only setup that you really need is basically what Anna said. Fred and Doris are in a relationship at this point. I think they're just starting to get there. I'm trying to court her. And then I want to represent Kris Kringle, and because she necessarily doesn't think that he is Santa Claus, she doesn't want me to.
All right.
Yeah. I've read the evening paper, Fred, and I'm worried. You seem to be fighting such a hopeless battle.
Actually, I'm rather confident. All the publicity is really working for us. Public sympathy is obviously behind Kris. I think we have a good chance.
What about your law firm? How are they going to react to your taking this case?
Well, actually, old Hayslip, the senior partner, called me in this afternoon. We are an old, established law firm, Mr. Gailey, with great dignity and prestige. We can't have one of our junior members making a public spectacle of himself. We are not in the business to prove some old crank is actually Santa Claus. In other words, if I don't drop the case, they'll drop me.
Well, then you'll have to give it up, won't you?
I can't let a client down. You wouldn't want me to walk out on Kris, would you?
Fred, I really care very deeply for you. I admire and respect you for your courage in taking this on, but I don't want to see you lose your position.
It's true. That, I might.
That would be irresponsible. People have to be realistic. I've certainly learned that. You can't give up your job for some sentimental whim.
It's more than a whim, Doris.
Stop dreaming, Fred.
Doris, there's something very beautiful about that old man. And very compelling, too. Representing Kris is the right thing to do. I won't let him down. And I'm a damn good lawyer, too, Doris. Just have faith in me.
I do, but it's not a question of having faith. You're bound to lose this case. That's just common sense.
Doris, faith is believing in something when common sense tells you not to. Your problem is you have too much common sense.
It's a good thing one of us has. It's quite an asset sometimes.
Can't you get over being afraid? Believe in people. People like Kris. In laughter and joy and love and all the other intangibles.
You can't pay the rent with intangibles.
And you can't live a life without them. At least I can't. I had hoped that me and Chris had broken through your armor, that you'd be ready to be more open-minded and open-hearted. Well, there's no use talking, is there?
I suppose not.
Then there's nothing left to say.
It's ironic. With all my common sense, I thought it was really going to work out this time.
So did I.
Goodbye, Fred.
And that is a scene from Miracle on 34th Street, Josh Caldwell, the actor playing Fred Gailey in the show, along with actress Anna Mujan, who plays Doris Walker in the production. And also here with us is the director, Luther Hansen. Luther, the toy drive for Shriners Hospital, including $1 concession, is for every new and unwrapped toy donated. Can you talk a little bit about that?
We've partnered with Shriners Hospital before when we did Peter Pan some years ago. It was interesting. In England, Peter Pan as a pantomime is very, very popular. And James Barry, when he wrote Peter Pan, made a deal with Ormond Street Children's Hospital in London that anytime anyone ever did Peter Pan, they would give a donation to the Ormond Children's Hospital instead of paying rights to him. So we did a similar thing with Shriners, if that makes sense. And so we like partnering with them, and we thought it would be a good way to contribute by having people bring toys.
Bringing some joy to the world. Yeah. At a time. And the play was delayed, too, because of the fire. We've been talking a lot about the campfire in Butte County. How hard was that decision to, Luther, to change the opening date?
The school, the campus closed, and so we were...
Didn't have a choice.
Yes.
So do each have a favorite moment in the play, something you can tell me real quickly, something that stirs your heart, or...
For me, it's this scene, just because I like getting my emotions out.
Yeah.
So it's just like a scene where everything is coming to sort of a climax and they're arguing and everything seems to kind of be falling apart. And that's my favorite part of the play. That sounds really depressing. and I just like how, you know, like everything is so broken. And then this man, Kris Kringle, seems to bring everything together, and he seems to kind of fix all of it, and that's kind of my favorite thing about the play. Like, even though there's so much going on and so much sadness and so much hurt, he kind of embodies the whole Christmas spirit and, like, I guess fixes or manages to make everything be happy.
Josh?
For me, it's probably the courtroom scene. Where I am in court and I do not want to give up on Chris. And the prosecutor is just going and going and trying to make Kris Kringle seem like he's crazy. And for me, I love the two actors that are playing Chris. And I absolutely enjoy being in that moment, knowing that I, as Fred Gailey, want to just help this man who... just wants to bring good cheer to the world and help kids. Like, that's it.
And Luther, what's your delight in this production that you wanted to bring this to people here in the Sacramento area?
I was going to say, after hearing the scene again, I like that. Although it's a feel-good play, the conflict is real. Mm-hmm. And the people involved, the characters involved, are a great conflict about it, which is what earns, I think, the right to a... can we say happy ending?
Yeah.
What's the youngest age you think that would be good for this play to attend?
Youngest age? I'd say six.
I was thinking six.
Yeah.
So this is a very family-friendly show.
Yeah, very, very. Bring the family. Bring everybody.
Well, it's a delight to have you all here today. Thank you for coming in. Luther Hansen, director of Miracle on 34th Street. Josh Caldwell, the actor playing Fred Gailey in the show, along with actress Anna Mujan. Is that correct?
Mujan.
I'll get that. She plays Doris Walker in the production. Thank you for coming in this morning. We appreciate you being here. Wish you great success with the show.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
We have more on our website at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. Welcome back to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Duncan in for Beth Rujak. The Philharmonic is the stage name of Christian Gates, a soul and R&B artist in Sacramento. He's made a name for himself with electrifying live performances all over town, and you can see him play this weekend at a benefit show for Campfire evacuees. Gates stopped by the Insight Studios in March to talk with Beth Rujak about his self-titled debut album released by Soul Life record label. Rujak asked Gates about his relationship, what it was like with the producing team.
They helped me with not only the rhetoric of the album, but with the support monetarily of getting it off the ground. And they've just been very instrumental in my ethics. They've just helped me in like every area, because sometimes you can get overwhelmed with a lot, because as an artist, independent artist, you got to do everything. Mm. So you got to do the music, then you got to do the booking, then you got to do the marketing and the social media, and just following all of that and being consistent, it's kind of hard.
And you have a choice, too, about whether you want to just go out and play your music or whether you want to play music and have a presence as a person and an opinion and a voice.
Right.
And so you're choosing more of the latter than the former.
Yeah, definitely. People need it. I want to give that message that it's okay to express ourselves in our entirety in our art. It's a piece of us. It doesn't really try to have an agenda. I wanted to do Good Day because there's a lot of people that struggle with that, including me. I struggle with depression and anxiety. And the song I wrote at 4 a.m, just super, super depressed, tears depressed. Sometimes we feel alone in that, and I just didn't want to feel that way. And I knew millions of others felt that way. And so I wanted to make a song for all of us.
Let's hear Good Day by the Philharmonic.
I wonder if I take another sip of this drink. Maybe I can make my problems all go away. But they always seem to return when I wake. There's really only so much more I can take. Just tryna have a good day, so just let me have a good day. I just wanna have a good day, so just let me have a good day. People pass me by with a smile on their face, and I smile back just to cover up the pain. I wanna tell somebody, but I'm too afraid that nobody else in the world will believe. I love and hate in this place that I can't escape. Rescue me, never mind, I'll just isolate all the way. I just wish you would go away. Please don't leave, I'd be glad that you would stay. Stay with me, please don't leave. I would rather you just stay with me. Please don't leave. Hope you have a good day, 'cause you gave me a good day. I just wanna have a good day, 'cause I didn't have a good day. I just wanna have a good day, so just let me have a good day. You shouldn't fight this on your own. No, 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 no. Just know that you are not alone. Rescue me, never mind, I'll just oscillate, hold on, wait. I just wish you would go away. Please don't leave. I would rather that you would stay. Stay with me. Please don't leave. I would rather you just stay with me. Please don't leave. Cause you gave me a good day when I haven't had a good day. So I hope you have a good day, cause you gave me a good day.
Good Day by the Philharmonic. You are going to perform another song for us. You want to tell me about it?
The song is called Colors, talking about how in life we have to help each other on this journey through both of our celebrations and our challenges. And sometimes it can get really rough. You have to realize that many of the things that we look for are things that exist inside every one of us if we seek it. And sometimes we are too busy trying to receive it instead of give it. And in this case, it's love. The theme of the song is, if all we want in life is unconditional love, then what we want is what we have to become. And it's a lifelong process.
Let's get to more music then from the Philharmonic.
Come out from the valley of the shadow of death. Take this in, I promise that you'll never run out of breath. Live your life, because sometimes I know it's hard to respect. When we hurt, that's the moment that we all wanna flex. I confess that as humans can be really complex. We flash our egos and we wanna call it our intellect. We show emotion and we think they're gonna think of us less. But you blessed, you should never ever think that you less. Cause in the end, we always our biggest enemies. But it's always against each other that we compete. 9 times out of 10, that's how it tends to be. Though this observation can be really hard to see. But if there's one thing that I hope you never fail to notice, is that our music's still beautiful though the record's broken. If all we want in life is unconditional love, then what we want is what we have to become, and that's love. If I told you I see colors too, that's a pop in the light that's inside of you. Maybe then I hope you recognize that true beauty always comes from inside. Don't you know I get the lucky guy every time I look into your eyes? Then I'm sure you'll recognize then that your beauty comes from within. Yo, if I told you about the beauty that I saw from within, would you for once let me shower you with some compliments or observations more or less, so I can help you forget for a second from the demons that you fight in your head? But what was said that make you look upon yourself with regret, cause of the torment of the words that make you think that you less? If I can't, let me give you something else to reflect, so you'll never have to guess that if you're worth it again. So let me take your pain that you're afraid to display and get the shackles off your feet, so maybe then we can dance. Cause you're like my Mona Lisa, that Da Vinci would paint. When I sprang forward, you fell back, and that's when the seasons changed. But even then, I could never look upon you with hate. Even though we had to break, I know we'll both be okay. So don't you ever think that for us it's way too late. At the end of the day, we grow better when we separate. But if there's one thing, then I'm hoping that you'll find that if it's yours, you should never have to fight. Cause you deserve all the air, colors, and light. So let those be the only words up in your mind. And if there's one thing that I hope you never fail to notice, is that our music's still beautiful though the record's broken. If all we want in life is unconditional love, then what we want is what we have to become, and that's love. If I told you I see colors too, that's a prop from the light that's inside of you. Maybe then I'll help you recognize that true beauty always comes from inside. Don't you know I get the look of God every time I look into your eyes? Then I'm sure you recognize then that your beauty comes from within. If I could go back to the moments that I felt the nostalgia as a kid before the pains of life began to be for me, to the moments that I cherish in my heart that are guarded to keep me on my path, even at points to the hardest. As time would pass, I grew older and levels would come and go. I relied on other people to fill the void in my soul, to be a high amongst my lows. That's when I lost my hope, cause at the point that they would leave, I ended up hurting more. Though at the time, my life really began to get messy, but that's the moment that I got to learn a valuable lesson. The worst thing that I'm feeling when I'm feeling most empty is that I cannot tell the difference between love and acceptance. That the reason why them people get addicted to drugs, to escape the pain of life so we live fast and die young, to avoid our problems we can never seem to run from. How can time heal any wounds if we can't get to confront? That's why in life, we gotta be our own leaders. Cause we as hurting people always hurt other people.
It's not because we're evil or even because we mean to. It's because we're broken and you needed me just like I need you. So if there's one thing that I hope you never fail to notice, is that our music's still beautiful though the record's broken. If all we want in life is unconditional love, then what we want is what we have to become, and that's love. If all we want in life is unconditional love, then what we want is what we have to become. If all we want in life is unconditional love, then what we want is what we have to become. Cause all I want in life is unconditional love, so what I want is what I'm gonna become. Cause all I want in life is unconditional love, so what I want is what I'm gonna become, and that's love.
That's the Philharmonic. You can see him, Hobo Johnson and the Lovemakers, James E. and more at a Campfire Benefit concert happening Sunday at Drake's, the Barn in West Sacramento. And you can also find more information and watch videos at our website, capradio.org/insight. That is Insight for today. I'm Beth Duncan. Insight is produced by Jen Picard, Bert Johnson, and Cody Dravel. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Today's engineer is Anthony Van Hook. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. We're back with another live show tomorrow. Thank you for joining us. Unconditional love, so what I want is what I'm gonna become. Cause all I want in life is unconditional love, so what I want is what I'm gonna become, and that's love.